Good evening. So, some of you may know this, but for the past few weeks, I haven't been here on Sunday because I've been finishing up a class that I was teaching in College Station on the book of Matthew. And there were a few things about the book of Matthew that stood out to me this most recent time of reading it. Namely, one of the prophecies that he gets to right at the beginning. Go ahead and turn to Matthew 2. And you can see that. Where is it? In verse 15, he says, and speaking of Jesus being in Egypt, says that this was done so that the word spoken through the Lord, by the Lord, through the prophet, might be fulfilled, saying, "Out of Egypt did I call my son." And if you go back and look up that prophecy in Hosea, it's not talking about a Messiah figure at all. It's indicting Israel, saying, God doesn't want to destroy you, Israel, because he pulled you out of Egypt as a son and taught you to walk. And the only way you can apply that to Christ is if you see Christ as kind of this fulfillment of what Israel was always supposed to be, right? And so once you get started on that line of thinking, you can really see that in the first few chapters of Matthew, right? You have the flight to Egypt as their Egypt bondage. Then you have his baptism as the crossing the Red Sea. And then you have, in chapter 4, is where it really gets interesting with that parallel, in that you look at the temptations that Jesus goes through, and you could really apply them to everything that Israel ever did wrong, right? But unlike Israel, he comes out on top, right? He succeeds over these temptations. And so for the rest of the book, he's kind of this super Israel, what Israel was always supposed to be. And if you go back to Isaiah, you can even see this. In Isaiah 49, Isaiah 49 verses 1 through 7 are definitely about a Messiah figure, right? Definitely about Christ. And talking about how he's going to show the glory of God. He's going to be the Redeemer. But in verse 3, he's referred to as Israel. "You are my servant Israel, in whom I will show my glory." Right? And so, okay, now I feel a little justified in having this conclusion. Let's see where it goes even further. And you can see it again in Matthew chapter 5 on the Sermon on the Mount, where he talks about the salt of the earth and the city set on a hill and these images. And he's talking about what Israel should have been. Right? They were supposed to be this people of God. They were supposed to be God's glory to the Gentiles. They were supposed to be the salt of the earth, but they've become tasteless. They were supposed to be a city on a hill, but they've been hidden. And he says, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law of prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill." So, in that sense, you can kind of see all of Israel's history, all of their law, as one big prophecy of Christ. But it's more than that, right? Because what was Israel besides the chosen people of God from all of mankind, right? Israel was supposed to be what God had planned for mankind. Israel was supposed to be the chosen people of God. And in that way, you can not only look at Christ as the perfect Israel, but also the perfection of what mankind was always supposed to be. And you can see that in Colossians 1. I can never get there. Colossians 1, verse 15. "And he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation." So that got me thinking about what does this firstborn of all creation mean? Right? obviously he was not the first created thing born, because he wasn't created, right? But what that Greek word firstborn mean does imply is primacy, right? He was the supreme of all creation. And well, in what way is Christ the perfect man? Well, he's God, right? But are there things that were different about him in becoming a man? Right? We just read from Hebrews 2, in which it says essentially that he was more qualified to be our high priest by the fact that he came and he was a man, he suffered all these things, and he was tempted as we were. Right? So what are some things that are unique to people, that people can be but not God? What was it about that situation that he had to become a person to become these things? And so we're going to look at three of those things tonight. And as much as we're supposed to be imitators of Christ, we're also going to look at how we can also become those things. Also try to be what God had always purposed for mankind, right? So the first one of these is kind of strange to think about, but humility, right? If you had to logically think about what does it mean for God to be humble, right? Does he submit to authority? No. Does he understand his place with respect to a greater power? Well, no, because he is that greater power. But Jesus, being coming down and being made a created thing, he is now in a position to do that. And we see him doing that. Right? We just read Hebrews 2:9, which is similar to that. You can turn back to Philippians chapter 2. And we see the same idea about how his humility is shown just in the incarnation. Right? In verses 6 through 8, Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So, he was humble in a way that God could not logically be humble. Well, what did he say about humility? Right, we can go look at that, and he has quite a bit of that in Matthew. But in Matthew 18, he has a series of teachings that are all very much about humility, but in kind of a strange sense. And basically, the thing that ties this whole chapter together is things that you should be putting above yourself, right? And he starts off with being asked about rank in the kingdom, right? Who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And he essentially tells them, you should be putting everybody above yourself. You should be a servant. And that's the person to whom the most glory is going to go, in kind of a paradoxical way. And then he moves on to this stumbling blocks, right? About making one of these little ones stumble. And, right, the salvation of others should be above your own needs. And then, if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. Your duty to God should be above even your own physical wholeness, right? Should be above your value of your own eye. And time again, we see this repeated throughout the whole chapter. And when we think of Jesus' humility, what's the ultimate example we think of? Well, the Garden of Gethsemane. He says, not my will, but thine be done. And he goes to submit himself to death. Right? Well, do all of these things always present themselves to us as opportunities to be humble? Are we always presented with the opportunity to go die for other people? Probably not. But there are many other ways to be humble, and many other ways to serve with humility. And 1 Peter says a lot about these things. One of the interesting things about the Peter's epistles that I'm realizing after studying Matthew is how much Peter learned in those years since since his ministry with Jesus. There's a lot of these things that he didn't understand during Jesus' life, a lot of these teachings that in the 30-plus years that he's had to think about them, he's really gained a lot of understanding. And so 1 Peter, I'd say about half of the book is devoted to ways for you to be submissive, right? Starting in chapter 2, he starts out in verse 13 with submitting to your government. He then goes on to servants submitting to your masters. You can extrapolate that to employer-employee relationships today. And in chapter 3, you have wives submitting to their husbands. And this is not contingent on the way any of these people act towards you, right? Some of these roles have an inherent authority that you need to submit to. But in chapter 8 of 1 Peter 3, he literally says that he sums it all up. In verse 8, he says, "To sum up, let all be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called by the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing." Right? And this is kind of contrary to our American idea of rights, but that's really all they are, is an American idea. Thomas Jefferson had the phrase that these are rights endowed by God, but God is telling us here that none of this matters. Just submit to your government. It's not a big deal. Right? And that's one of the ways we can be more Christ-like, and in that way be more like what God has planned for us to be, is not only to be submissive to these earthly things, but also to be submissive to God. And that's why he's given us this example of Jesus, because he was submissive to God even in that final, you have to die for mankind, right? And if we can't submit to our earthly authorities, how are we going to submit to a God who we can't see, right? But at the end of this talk in 1 Peter 3, towards verse 13, he moves on to one time when you shouldn't just sit down and submit, right? "And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation. Do not be troubled. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Keep a good conscience, that in the thing which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ might be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you should suffer for doing good, for doing what is right, rather than doing what is wrong." Right? Submitting to God is above all those things. And sometimes that's going to take another very human quality that we're going to move on to, which is courage. Right? You can maybe talk about God having been courageous in creating mankind because he's risking them not returning his love. But in a way, like Christ was afraid of maybe dying and had to be courageous in that. It's kind of strange to think about God doing that. And I was reading a book recently by, I don't know if you've heard of G.K. Chesterton, but he's just a turn of the century, 1900s kind of theologian. But he was talking about this idea of the Christian God being courageous, which is kind of a strange idea. And he says that a good man may have his back to the wall is no more than we know already. But that God could have his back to the wall is a boast for all insurgents forever. Christianity is the only religion on earth that has felt that omnipotence made God incomplete. Christianity alone has felt that God, to be holy God, must have been a rebel as well as a king. Alone of all creeds, Christianity has added courage to the virtues of the Creator. For the only courage worth calling courage must necessarily be when the soul passes a breaking point is and does not break. So, if we want to see this, we can obviously look at Jesus' life, right? We've already looked at Philippians, where he's given up glory in heaven to come and do this for us. And we can look at instances like Matthew 21 and many more instances in the book of Matthew where he stands up to the chief priests of Israel and rebukes them to their face because they're not doing what's right and they're abusing their power over the common man. But he doesn't fear their fear, right? And so in verse 40 of Matthew 21, he says, "Therefore, when the owners of the vineyard come, what will he do to those vine growers?" Speaking about these horrible vine growers who were killing all of the agents of the vineyard owner. And it's a very obvious parallel to the Pharisees. "And the Pharisees said to him, 'He will bring those wretches to a wretched inn and will rent out the vineyard to other vine growers who will pay him the proceeds at the proper season.' Jesus said to them, 'Did you never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone? This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and will be given to a nation producing the fruit of it. And he who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust.' And when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they understood that he was speaking about them. And they sought to seize him, but they feared the multitudes, because they held him to be a prophet." And in these last few chapters of Matthew, where he's in Jerusalem teaching, it's really like the gloves are off with respect to the Pharisees. He's standing up to them basically on every issue that they're doing, which is a lot. And he's not afraid because he's doing God's purpose, right? We talked about all those things that we were to submit to, but one thing that we were not supposed to submit to was you always need to be ready to be standing up to give a defense for your faith. And yeah, God's name being slandered is the one thing you're not supposed to submit to. And that's seen in Jesus' life. And as we also saw in Philippians, his death on the cross is the ultimate show of courage, right? Before he was incarnated, he was a being that never would have had to die. He didn't have to do that, right? We're used to thinking about people who we all die once, we all are born once, we all die once. Well, he just always was, and he was going to always be. But he came down and died for us. So, what does this have to do with us? How can we be more courageous? Right? Go over to Hebrews 12. We just looked at this a couple weeks last week with Nathan's lesson on running the race. Hebrews 12, verses 1 through 3. "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance, the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race which is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down on the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart." Right? The Bible all the time tells us about all these trials that we're going to have to face. Right? You can go back to 1 Peter where he spends multiple chapters talking about the persecutions that are about to come to the first century church. And we saw a little bit there, right? You can count yourself blessed if you are being persecuted for doing what is good, but what does it mean if you're enduring harsh treatment for doing what is wrong? Right? It has to do with a purpose, right? Nobody is ever courageous in the face of danger just because, right? They always have a reason. For the soldier, it's the love of his country, but for the Christian, it's the love of his God, but also the hope that he's gotten in Jesus, the hope of heaven, hope of eternal life with God. So, what's the... Following this line of thinking, I have to think of one other thing that men can be, but God cannot be. And that is a priest, right? So, what would it mean for God to be a priest? A priest is one who ministers to God. God can't minister to himself. And that was one of the things that Jesus came down to do. So go ahead and turn to Hebrews. This is basically we still are in Hebrews, I guess. Hebrews chapter 7. This is basically what most of the book of Hebrews is about, right? The priesthood of Christ, the high priesthood of Christ. So at the end of chapter 7, verse 26, "For it was fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens, who does not need daily, like those priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people, because this he did once and for all, when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints a son, made perfect forever." Right? We think of the priests of the Old Testament. They had a relationship with God based on it was kind of arbitrary how they were chosen. They had the 12 tribes of Israel, and Aaron was of the tribe of Levi, and he said, "The Levites shall be my inheritance for the rest of time." Right? And from those, the sons of Aaron will be my priests. And it was basically just that made them priests. But here, the Hebrew writer is making the point that Jesus doesn't need such arbitration to make him a priest. He's a priest on his own merit. He's worthy to minister to God on his own merit. But the rest of mankind is not on their own merit. And so, here we're faced with another problem, in that, what's the point if there's only one person who's worthy to be in God's presence? And this is a problem to God, right? And a problem to Christ as well. And we see it remedied in chapter 9 through the sacrifice of Christ. So in chapter 9, in verse 11, "But when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of heifers sprinkling those who have been defiled sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" So, by his high priesthood, by his sacrifice, we've been cleansed into a state that we can now approach God, right? So what does it mean for us to be priests? We can't exactly, enter in the presence of God on our own merit and give ourselves as a sacrifice for all mankind, can we? No. That's the duty of the high priest. And if you head on back to 1 Peter chapter 2, he talks about, right, the living stone. In verse 4, it says, "In coming to him as a living stone, rejected by men, but choice and precious in the sight of God, you also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." And skip down to verse 9, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For what you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had received mercy, but now you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust, with which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So this kind of sums up what it is to be priests, in that now that we've been cleansed by the blood of God, by the blood of Christ, we see in 1 John that we have fellowship with God, right? And we also are now worshipers of God, and we're His people, right? In that same way that we were talking about how Israel was always meant to be the people of God, to be the glory of God to the Gentiles, that's what we are today as His priesthood, right? He says in verse 9 that you are this nation of priests so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you, right? So that you may keep yourselves blameless from the Gentiles. And this is what the people of God are meant to do, right? We saw that in Matthew 5 with how they were supposed to be the salt of the earth, the city set on a hill, the light of the world. And all of this is inspired by what Christ was. And so the call to be Christ-like is not just a repetition of the command to be godly, right? There are things about Christ that are different, and I realize that this is a kind of short lesson, but I want to, if you take one thing away from this, it's something new to look for as you strive for things to imitate about Christ, right? It's not just your typical, well, He's God, I should strive to be more like God. Jesus did a lot of things that are more pertinent to us than even God could have done. And that's the point of the scripture reading that Noah read for us, in that He's the high priest who was made in all things like us. So hopefully as you go about reading Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, and seeing Jesus' life, you can find new things to understand about Him and new things to emulate about Him. And for any of those who do need an invitation, we're ready to accommodate you at this time. If there are any among you who would wish to become part of this great priesthood that is cleansed by the blood of Christ, which the Hebrew writer says is so holy that he cleansed the temple not made with hands with His blood. He cleansed heaven with His blood. He sanctified heaven with this blood, and it's ready to sprinkle any of you that need it. So if you would like to become part of this priesthood, go ahead and come forward, and if you need to be baptized, and if you need the prayers of the congregation, we're ready to help you with that. If you would, come as we stand and sing. I know.